200 years from now, when the historians are piecing together the end of the American Republic, they will have an incredible resource to them in the form of that great scribe of American liberty, James Bovard. He's the author of, let me not forget here, Lost Rights, Freedom in Chains, The Fair Trade Fraud, The Farm Fiasco, Shakedown, Feeling Your Pain, Terrorism and Tyranny, The Bush Betrayal, and the latest one, and my favorite one, is Attention Deficit Democracy. Welcome back to Chaos Radio, Mr. Bovard.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, it's great to have you here. And, I guess we'll just start with the most important of the big news, and that is the end of the writ of habeas corpus in America. Can you help explain for our audience exactly what habeas corpus is and in what way it may be endangered by this new Military Commissions Act that George Bush is due to sign any day?
Well, habeas corpus is something that goes back to the Magna Carta, goes back, that's almost 800 years. This was it's a Latin term which basically means that it's a legal procedure used to force the government to bring charges against someone that they're holding. It's a way to force, to prevent the government from holding people in secret, in perpetuity without charging them. There are different ways to interpret this. This is something which was in the Constitution even outside the Bill of Rights. It was in there even before the Bill of Rights was added to the Constitution. It was, it's been a part of the English law, at least in theory, going back 800 years and made official, I believe, in the late 1600s after the Great Revolution in England. And it's interesting that people now, a lot of Bush supporters and a lot of people in the administration think that we don't need to have habeas corpus because the government never makes any mistakes, or at least the government should never be forced to admit it makes mistakes.
Right. Well, and I guess under that theory, we really don't have any right. Why do we need a habeas corpus if they never make mistakes or should never have to admit them?
Yeah, there was a story. I did a story for the Boston Globe editorial page back in July. I got it on my website called the terrorist batting average, and it's in over 90% of the cases where the Bush administration has said that people were terrorists or terrorist suspects, it turns out that the evidence fell through, or there never was any evidence.
Right. Only we're lucky in those cases that most of those, I guess, were people who actually were turned over to the court system, so we even were able to hear about them. Under this new system, when these mistakes are made, we won't even be able to know.
Well, it should cut down the paperwork.
Yeah.
It's really tragic to see how few people understand why they need any protection from the government, because that's what this all comes down to. Do Americans in the year 2006 need to be protected from George Bush, from Dick Cheney, from Rumsfeld, and from any federal agent who has a grudge? And the founding fathers understood that that even a government of the people could be a threat to the people.
Now, where in the Constitution does Congress have the power to suspend the writ of habeas corpus anyway? Because by my reading of it, the only mention of that power is a restriction against it. But nowhere is it specifically enumerated in the first place.
Well, there's a hidden asterisk about George Bush being God.
Oh, you know, I didn't see that.
Oh, well, it's in the new improved edition.
Article 9 in there.
Article 9. That's akin to, was it Article 58 that the in the Soviet criminal code that they would use for anybody suspected of being a dissident? I think it was Article 58, but, Congress does not have authority to suspend this, but it doesn't matter. Senator Specter gave a very impassioned and eloquent plea in opposition of this part of the bill, and then Specter voted for it anyhow.
Right, and said, "Oh, don't worry, the courts will clean out the bad parts."
You wonder what these guys are getting paid for, aside from taking care of the pages. It is simply amazing that you would have so many people take an oath of office to uphold the Constitution and then feel like that any time that they had a chance to benefit from stabbing the Constitution in the back, they could do it.
Well, we're in a kind of a peculiar situation here because, frankly, the Constitution hasn't existed for the entire time that any of these men have been in office. I mean, as far as the limited republic that the Constitution creates, basically, the only words in the Constitution with any relevance are the ones that create the three branches of government. But beyond that, I mean, they've been able to do whatever they want for quite a long time now, right?
Well, they've been able to do almost whatever they want since 9/11. I mean, it hasn't been, you know, there have been judges who have taken taken a stand and struck down some of the worst laws and some of the worst policies. There have been individual congressmen who have taken brave stands of both parties. There have been people who have done the right thing, standing on their rights recognized by the Constitution. So the of course, there's the old saying, the Constitution isn't perfect, but it's better than what we've got now.
Right.
I think people have been saying that since the 1930s, actually, or maybe even earlier.
Right.
Maybe H.L. Mencken would use that line in one of his Monday columns. And so the Constitution, it has been there. It is there. I mean, it has about as much binding power at this point as the Ten Commandments have on a... no, that's a crude joke. I won't make it on chaos radio. Scott, I hate to embarrass you with that kind of humor.
Oh, well, you could have gotten away with it, but that's all right. So help me understand. What is this unitary executive theory? Is there anything to this theory at all, or is this basically just bullshit to justify doing what they want, the rule of men?
Well, you know, I think this goes back to Article 9 of the Constitution.
Yeah.
The new asterisk pushes God. You know, it's sad, you know, the Federalist Society, a lot of these theories have come out of the Federalist Society, and these folks had some very good points in the 70s and 80s when liberals were basically running amok and acting like the government, acting as if there should be no limit on government's power to control the economy. These folks made some very good points and some very good counterpunching. Nowadays, these folks are targeting any limits on the power of the president. And there is nothing. For instance, John Yoo is the most famous proponent of this theory. And Yoo's first book basically argued that the Constitution didn't mean what it said it meant when it said that Congress had to make the declaration of war. Yoo basically argued that the president could do it at his whim, and that's what the founding fathers wanted. But for some reason, they didn't get around to saying so in the Constitution.
Oh, really? Now, that's a novel argument. Not just that, well, nuclear weapons and hijacker terrorists have changed things since those quaint old days, but even that's really what James Madison meant in the first place.
Well, you know, and it's interesting to see people that are very intelligent with zero intellectual scruples. There are some folks who think that just because someone is an author or is an intellectual, then somehow he's trustworthy. I mean, yeah, trustworthy is the average congressman. There have been so many writers and so many intellectuals that have told so many howling lies to apologize for Bush and his actions and his power grabs, and yet people don't recognize that. People don't recognize that political writers are often as corrupt as the politicians that they write about.
All right, now, we need to really get to what happened last week. This is, as far as I can tell, one of the largest transfers of authority from a Congress that never had it in the first place to a president who didn't deserve it in the history of America, and yet, as you say, it just goes unremarked upon, unnoticed almost. The Patriot Act was bad, but this Military Commissions Act, as I understand it, is the Patriot Act times 10.
Yeah, this is, I don't know if it's times 10, but it's much worse. I mean, the Patriot Act, you know, did not have the smoking guns that this torture-dictatorship bill has, and it's a torture bill because it basically makes legal the torture that the U.S. did from 2001 to the end of 2005. It pardons all the torturers, almost all the torturers, and all the torture policymakers, many of whom should be facing war crime charges, I think, probably, or at least investigations for war crimes. And it says that the president and the Secretary of Defense, as I understand, have the power to designate anybody, an enemy combatant, and strip them of all rights and cast them in this legal purgatory. But it's not even a legal purgatory because, you know, there's no legal there. It's just the, it's on the whim of these supreme commanders. So it's a torture dictatorship bill, and it was explicit, and there were folks that laid it out, and was not rushed into law like the Patriot Act was, in the weeks after 9/11. And this is a torture bill that's gone through. You know, it's fascinating to hear people say, well, but Abu Ghraib, the photos we saw in May of 2004, that wasn't torture. Well, you know, many of the things indicated there, I think, were torture, but there were far, far worse things that have come out since Abu Ghraib. There have been the FBI memos that came out from the FBI agents who visited down in Guantanamo and wrote back and said, hey, this is torture. There was the evidence of torture at Bagram Air Base, where they were tearing out toenails of some of the Afghan detainees. There was the sleeping bag method, in which the U.S. soldiers in Iraq captured and they had an Iraqi general, and they stuffed him in the sleeping bag, set on his face, and prevented him from breathing as part of the interrogation. He died, which kind of ruined the interrogation. But that was known as the sleeping bag method. There have been all kinds of other ways that the U.S. agents or U.S. soldiers have brutalized people in Afghanistan, Iraq, and elsewhere. And who knows, in these secret prisons in Eastern Europe or elsewhere.
Right.
It's interesting. I was just jotting down some notes earlier. I was in London in May, and I visited the Tower of London. And that was such a symbol of torture in British history, in English history. And there was a small plaque in there about the history of torture at the Tower, and it was kind of people were thinking, yeah, it was really bad back in the 1400s and 1500s. And now we've got Bush bringing back torture, trying to make torture respectable.
Well, so I'm confused, because I thought Abu Ghraib was just a couple of bad apples. Why would they need to legalize it?
You know, it's not a question of bad apples. It's a question of, well, first of all, they were one of the greatest injustices of Abu Ghraib happened at the trial of the corporal from Pennsylvania, Charles
Grainer,
yeah. He was almost certainly guilty as all get out, and you know he certainly deserves some punishment. But if memory serves, he was prevented from introducing into court at his court martial evidence that he was following orders from his superiors. And, you know, it's hard to think of a more brazen miscarriage of justice. But that's the kind of evidence which should have gotten out, but there was a show trial element to that entire thing. It was as if the Bush administration was happy to have a scapegoat. Yeah, here's some bum, let's throw him to the media and move on, and thank God that we handled this responsibly.
Well, isn't that reassuring for America's torturers? You know, they're promised in the memo, in the paperwork, that don't worry, as long as you say that you're following orders, you can torture anybody you want to death. And then when they do, they say, oh, following orders? No, we never gave him any orders.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting, if you go back to the John New torture memo that the White House then counsel Alberto Gonzalez asked for in May of 2000, in August of 2002, you explicitly dealt with the Nuremberg principles on whether or not a person who committed war crimes could be excused because he was following orders. And basically what you did and the Bush administration embraced was this cutesy little stuff about, well, it's not really a war crime if this, if that, if this other. And they basically tried to treat the Nuremberg principles in the same way that a drunk driver would try and treat some breath analyzer test. Whoops, kind of messed that one up. Whoops, had a problem there. Whoops, it doesn't count because of this. You know, just a totally craven attitude towards any notion that the U.S. government is obliged to do justice either to Americans or to anybody else in the world.
Now, correct me if I'm going off the story here, but when I was a kid, which was only in the 70s and 80s, I remember that I was taught that America had a rule of law, and that's what made it a better country than, for example, the Soviet Union. And that here, just because people worked for the state, didn't mean that they could just go around doing whatever they liked. They were still bound by the very same laws that apply to the rest of us. And it sounds to me, I mean, it's easy, I guess, for somebody driving by and listening to not know where the hyperbole ends and the you know, hard facts begin or something here. But I really want to make it clear. I mean, we really are talking about the end of the even the pretext of having a rule of law in this country. The president is the law. He can make up the law. He can torture who he wants. He can do whatever he wants.
Yeah, so much of what Bush has done is such a complete travesty of American values, of what's been understood as American values, and what Americans have been taught that their country stands for. And yet, you know, it's my impression that what's happened in secret in this White House is far worse than what we've found out about so far. But I think that but there were so many things that we have found out about before, yet people shrugged them off. People really haven't paid attention. People have just kind of waltzed their way along and acted like it didn't really, it's football season, or, you know, how's the Tour de France doing, or whatever. People have simply not paid attention, and that's, it doesn't surprise me. We're talking about cotton subsidies. Okay, cotton subsidies, they aren't going to hold your attention if you're not in cotton land or someone following the budget closely or whatever. But this is torture we're talking about, and torture failed to hold the interest of the American people.
Is that the biggest difference between, say, you know, the late 70s and early 80s and now, is that if this kind of thing was going on then, people actually would have cared?
Is
that giving the 70s too much credit?
I don't know. I mean, Nixon lost power in part because there was a sense that he had made himself above the law. Bush has done the same thing, and he still had huge cheering sections for this. It's interesting to think of how popular it would be if his war in Iraq had not basically turned to crap. And Bush would have much higher approval ratings, even though he has acted like a dictator, even though he has claimed to be above the law, even though he has imposed secret government in this country, even though his people have arrested large, large numbers of innocent people and falsely charged them as terrorists. He would be very popular if Iraq was not going badly. So, I think people have less understanding of the danger of government now than they had in the 1970s. Nixon in Vietnam, I think, really woke some people up, at least temporarily. Jimmy Carter had such an aura of incompetence to him. And Ronald Reagan actually had a good message as far as that the government has too much power and government should not be running our lives. But we haven't heard that in a long time.
Yeah, and the people who call themselves, you know, the heirs of Ronald Reagan, the people who I kind of liked in the 1990s for how much they detested Bill Clinton and his government, these are the same people who are willing to defend Bush and his administration no matter what.
Yeah, it's sad to see. I mean, there were lots of folks who made very principled what appeared to be principled criticisms of Clinton, and now they're just shameless shills for Bush. There are some noteworthy exceptions, people like Bob Barr. Barr has come through beautifully. Not many others at all, actually. And people like Don DeVine of the American Conservative Union has stood up for principle. The editors of the American Conservative have done great. But maybe that's why the prospects are challenging for that magazine. So
talk about people's just not even caring, just going right on with the Tour de France or the football game or whatever. And part of me, and you know, probably, Jen, this is just when I'm making excuses for my neighbors as best I can, I think that really what we're talking about here is just MYOB rather than ADD. And that most people really are just living their lives and trying to do their own thing and get by. It's hard enough with the tax man beating down their door and, you know, regulating their every enterprise. And they're just trying to survive, and they don't have time in their life to devote to what their government is doing to other people. They're just trying to survive it themselves, you know? What about that?
If the government did not pose any threat to them or to their children or to their grandchildren, whatever, that might make sense. But it's not like this is some distant threat, you know, that only exists on the other side of the world. If you look at the powers in this new law, there's nothing to stop them from doing torture here or using practices that the rest of the world recognizes as torture. There are provisions in the in at least one of the treaties that the U.S. has signed, I think, that require consistency based on what the U.S. would use abroad and at home. So this is a huge Pandora's box that very few people have realized, very few people have recognized. And, you know, the open claim of dictatorial power, which is what this enemy combatant stuff has been since November 2001, that the president has a right to nullify all rights of anybody he says is a bad guy or a really bad guy, and with no evidence. And as y'all have documented on antiwar.com, many, if not most, of the cases down there at Guantanamo are bogus.
Yep.
There are so many people that have just been grabbed by bounty hunters in Pakistan and Afghanistan and sent off to Cuba. And it's not in the U.S. government's interest to admit that it screwed up massively.
Yeah, well, and I'm going to take the most famous case, the American, Jose Padilla. You look at his case, the man was innocent. I mean, you read his indictment, they say he knew a guy who knew a guy who sent some money to the Mujahideen in Chechnya, you know, as though our government weren't backing them anyway. They accused him of, you know, he was going to set off a radioactive bomb, he was going to level all these high-rise apartment complexes, so it was absolutely necessary to be turned over to the Navy. And now you look at the guy and you know that they basically made it all up. In fact, this was on the antiwar.com website as well, that the FBI agent who originally arrested Padilla said, "I didn't want to arrest him, I wanted to turn him into an informant." And in fact, it seems to me like that's where they made up the dirty bomb plot right there, was they wanted him. That was their mission for Padilla. They wanted him to make up a dirty bomb plot, and it would be a great sting. And he refused to cooperate. Next thing you know, they turn around and charge him with a dirty bomb plot. And they just made it up, Jim.
Well, you know, it's important for people not to lose faith in John Ashcroft.
Yeah. Yeah, well, the voters in Missouri preferred a corpse to him. That's how he got the job as Attorney General in the first place. His people went, see, who am I going to vote for, Ashcroft or this festering corpse in the ground? I'm voting for the corpse.
Well, yeah, and it's sad because Ashcroft made the entire system of justice fester.
Yeah, right. They should have left him in the Senate.
Well, yeah, I haven't forgotten the hyperventilating press conference that Ashcroft had from Russia, Moscow, I think in June 2002 on the Jose Padilla case. And just this, you know, this intense drama. And even people in the White House the next day were saying, yeah, well, he's sort of exaggerated, you know. And it's funny to see, you know, this was supposedly their biggest scoop, and all of a sudden they're kind of backing off real quick. John, you take some shots at Ashcroft in his book. Now, you talked about how Ashcroft did not like intellectuals. And it's kind of like, what's this like code word for, you know? Ashcroft did not seem to be very studious, let's put it like that. He seems to have Bush's reading habits without Bush's nuance.
Right. Yeah, you know, one of the things, too, about this, on the subject of more the people's inattention, is you kind of make the case in the book, Attention Deficit Democracy, that it's not so much that people aren't paying attention. I mean, people, they are paying attention and they do care. It's just they're wrong about everything. You know, they show up at an election and they believe with all their heart that their vote counts and that they really like the guy they're voting for and that it matters. And that then that makes everything okay.
Well, sometimes the vote does matter, and sometimes people like or dislike a person for the right reason. The thing that's frustrating is it's been so easy for the politicians it's been so easy for the politicians to muddy the waters in people's heads. Part of the reason it's easy for politicians to get away with lies is because the news media is so docile. Or the news media sees itself as a partner with the government. That's how it is often is in Washington. People like Bob Woodward are you know, practically part of Bush's kitchen cabinet for years. And there's a certain coziness there, which is profoundly corrupting, as if some journalists were not already corrupt.
Right. Yeah, and TV really rules the day. I guess it used to be that people went to their bowling league or their softball game or whatever it is, but now everybody just sits home and watches TV. There's no real discussion about it. It's all just kind of one-way communication.
Well, and it's one way for people who don't read the newspapers themselves very often. Talking to broadcast journalists, every now and then I run to one who's well-informed and has a pretty good handle on the issues which he's broadcasting about, but often they don't seem to go past the headlines on the front pages of the newspapers. And they're just a tool of whatever information is put onto their teleprompter.
Yep. Have you ever read a book called Technopoly by Neil Postman?
No, I haven't.
Well, I'm recommending it to you now, and I'm going to go ahead and tell you a little bit about it. He basically just concludes that America is the first society in world history that has completely surrendered our culture to technology, and that really no matter, and even, you know, take all the different regional cultures and what have you that used to exist in this country, that really they are unable to withstand the onslaught of gadgets. That basically any gadget that can be invented will be invented and will be implemented. And so when it's cheap enough to put cameras up on every street corner, they put cameras up on every street corner. Nobody says boo about it. They don't hold an election about it or a referendum or anything. It just happens. And that, you know, the idea of trying to have some sort of limited constitutional government or something like that in an era where the computer power is not just so powerful, but so portable, that basically we're just fighting a losing battle against. It's not even an agenda. It's simply ability.
Well, you know, every now and then politicians do take a stand against the gadgets. I seem to recall that the state of Alabama banned vibrators a couple of years ago.
Oh, good. Yeah.
I'm not really sure if that was really what Neil Postman had in mind.
Yeah, I hope not.
That's telling a good book. I should read it. I don't know that that's the answer all here. Because, you know, it's a lot easier to get basically dissident news sources now than it was 20 years ago. With a place like Anti-War with a lot of links to the British or the French or the German press, or some of the Arab press, it's possible to get, we're much less beholden to the three broadcast networks from the Washington Post and the New York Times. But it seems that even with the easy access to that much more credible foreign information, that, a large number of Bush supporters still think that Saddam was behind 9/11, for instance.
Yeah, two-thirds of them in the latest poll.
Yeah, I mean, that does raise questions about the Voting Rights Act, Voting Rights Act ban on literacy tests.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just astounding that that folks would be so bonded with this, nonsense. But it's been very profitable for the Bush administration, and Bush in his anniversary talk on 9/11, I think he mentioned Iraq something like 40 or 50 times. So, you know, it's not surprising people would think that there might be some kind of connection.
Right. Now, there's something else that you've covered a lot in your books in the past, in terms of American liberty being eroded, and that's the war against drugs, so-called. And I wonder, you know, there's so much going on with the American government killing people overseas. I'm almost just entirely consumed by foreign policy most days. I don't even really know how the war on drugs has been going in these Bush years.
Same old, basically. People that use drugs and the government goes after them, they're still SOL. Marijuana arrests, I think, are around 780,000 per year. And it's interesting to see the level of agitation on a simple arrest like this. I was going to a grocery store nearby a week or two ago, and there was some young white guy, blonde hair, just didn't look too sharp, but he'd apparently been seen smoking something he was throwing away, and the cops had grabbed him, and there were two squad cars there and three or four cops, and the kid was in handcuffs, and they were the cops were having this conference. It was like that they just caught some damn Unabomber. I mean, but there was, okay, it was a kid smoking the wrong kind of cigarette, and I guess it's a full employment program for cops. It makes them, you know, it gives them a sense of purpose in life. But it's such a total failure of, well, first of all, it's a complete injustice, because marijuana smokers don't pose a public peril. I mean, it might make them passive or whatever, but it doesn't turn them into a chainsaw murderers. It's not the government's damn business. And it's such a total waste of law enforcement resources, and it undermines the government's duty to protect people against real threats. So,
right. I mean, that's what I'm really concerned about is those of us who had never dared, you know, smoke pot or do some terrible thing like that, we still end up having to suffer under this same system.
Everybody pays for this kind of crap because it just messes up the entire criminal justice system. It makes law enforcement more expensive, more intrusive. It leads to these indoctrination programs in government schools, which people are practically taught to think that smoking dope will make them grow a third testicle. And it just it has such an adverse effect on the society as a whole. And there are so many ways in which the war on drugs does more harm than the drugs themselves.
Yeah, how many Americans are in prison right now?
Oh, 2 million plus, a little bit, I guess, around that.
Which, how does that compare to, say, Russia or China?
Oh, I think that the U.S. may have the highest percentage in the world. I'm not sure. South Africa or Russia might be higher. There's one country that's sometimes mentioned as having a higher percentage, but I think that might vary according to the press report, but... the U.S. certainly has the highest or second highest incarceration rate in the world.
Wow.
And a large part of that's due to the war on drugs.
And again, I guess that's part of the society. The people were also separated from each other, I guess. People just don't even notice or something. I mean, it seems like 2 million people disappear off into dungeons. There would be some kind of outcry.
Well, it's not dungeons, but it's not so much, you know, it's people that are arrested for drug violations don't disappear in the same way that people arrested for terrorist violations do. Because usually someone's arrested for drugs, it's possible for the family to find out where they are. There are charges, sometimes bogus.
For now, but you know, I mean, George Bush himself has announced that using drugs is material support for terrorism, isn't it?
Bush has made some comments has Bush said something like that recently? I mean, he said some dribble about that in the past. Has George Bush freshened up his dribble on this subject?
No, I haven't heard that one lately. Actually, that was something that I read in your book when I was going back over it this morning.
Okay.
Which, by the way, the greatest laugh in all libertarianism, you just heard it, it's James Bovard. He's the author of a million books, but the last one is Attention Deficit Democracy. It's really good. You hear me talk about this guy and reading his articles up here every week on Chaos Radio.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, oh, and you know, this is another thing that I was reminded of when I was watching your C-SPAN interview, was the mention of civil forfeiture statutes and people having their cash seized, whether at the airport or having their property seized when their property is accused of a crime, and then they have to basically sue to get it back. I know there's something you covered at length in your previous books that you wrote back during the Clinton years. I think, wasn't Feeling Your Pain, didn't you talk about civil forfeiture in that one?
Right. I had a chapter on that. I had a long section on that in Lost Rights. I discussed it briefly in Freedom and Chains. Yeah, I mean, this is the naked government power, where they just come in, make an accusation, and as soon as it's similar to the enemy combatant stuff, but it's only with property. With civil forfeiture, the rules have been set up that the government can come in, make an accusation, and seize your property, and therefore prevent you from hiring a lawyer to defend yourself.
Oh, how nice. And then you have to sue them, and the burden of proof is on you if you want to get it back.
Right, and the cost of suing them is easily $5,000 or $10,000. So if they seize $3,000 in cash, then you're up the creek without a paddle, basically. Yeah. There were some changes in procedure in a 2000 so-called Fix Act on this, a Reform Act, but I don't think it really fixed the problem. I mean, many of the problems are still there. I've not looked at the details of this lately, part because it's been, you know, there's so much terrorism stuff going on. I haven't followed the forfeiture and drug laws as close as I would have liked to.
Well, you know, it seems like in the American system that abuses could be prevented in a program like that, just as long as if the agents seize your money without the proper authority or what have you, or proper pretext, then you get to hold them personally accountable, right? I mean, you don't just sue the DEA, you can sue the DEA agents who stole your money, right?
Well, you know, Scott, I'm glad you've got a healthy fantasy life. Yeah, I'm sure a federal judge is going to welcome that. Yeah, sure, step right in here with your case, you know. Yeah, sure, why not? Pro se, why not? No problem. That's how it should be. And if memory serves, there were law cases like that in the early history of the U.S.
Yes, yeah, then the First Amendment, my right to petition for redress of grievances, right?
Well, yeah, but if you filed that type of petition now in D.C., it would probably just be handled by some page.
Yeah, yeah. If lucky, he's not getting preyed on by some Republican congressman.
Yeah. Well, you know. Yes, that's true. I'm trying so hard to be high-minded here.
Oh, yes. Yes, me too. Speaking of high-minded, well, and this is why I really brought up the joke about holding these government criminals personally accountable for their behavior. I saw an article last week that some federal judge, a George H.W. Bush appointee, has ruled that John Ashcroft does not have sovereign immunity and that he can be held liable for things that happened to some poor innocent guy under John Ashcroft's detainee program. And the judge, the language that I read said, hey, as long as he was involved in formulating the policy, he can be held accountable. And I thought, oh my God, the American Republic is saved after all.
I think this was Judge Edward Lodge out in Idaho, is that right?
Sounds right.
Yeah. I'm pulling it up here as we speak. This is the same judge who had jurisdiction in the first Ruby Ridge trial.
Oh.
And he was a judge that busted the FBI's chops again and again for all kinds of misconduct with evidence. And busted the federal prosecutor's chops again and again. And it got so extreme that the Justice Department's chief prosecutor basically had a nervous breakdown as he was starting his closing argument.
Uh-huh.
You know.
Well, and I could see why
that was a great laugh, Scott. Kind of like, oh yeah, well, you know.
I could see the judge holding a grudge because Lon Horiuchi, they tried to prosecute him in Idaho, and the national government came and said he had sovereign immunity and protected him, right?
Well, yeah, Lodge was also presiding over that case, if memory serves, and he, I was not pleased with how he did there, but with the first Ruby Ridge trial, if memory serves, Lodge put out a statement or a list after the ruling, basically walking through some of the federal misconduct and abuses in that case. I might be mistaken on that, but Lodge did some excellent stuff in that. What happened last week was Lodge refused to dismiss a lawsuit brought by a former University of Idaho football player, a lawsuit against Ashcroft because the feds had grabbed this guy after they'd grabbed somebody else, some other Muslim in Idaho, and they'd held this guy as a material witness basically on totally bogus grounds. So Ashcroft could be in trouble because this is a tough judge. He's held the feds accountable before. And it was a great tribute to Idaho that the jury out there did not convict Randy Weaver back in 1993.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had forgotten about the nervous breakdown, but I did remember that that trial was such a farce that Jerry Spence, the lawyer, as Cletus the Slack-jawed Yokel says, I want me that fancy lawyer with the cowboy hat from the TV. He went in there, and all he did was cross-examine the government's witnesses and walked out of there with an acquittal. He didn't even call a single witness of his own. Just got up there, cross-examined the government's witnesses, and, you know, trashed them.
Well, yeah, and there were some other excellent lawyers, other defense lawyers. David either Niven or Nevin, I'm not sure. I always forget which one it is, but he was one of the lawyers there. He did some excellent work. And the feds just came in there so arrogant. The feds were strutting through there. The feds were strutting in the courtroom the same way they have strutted on the mountainside when they went after Randy Weaver and his family.
Well, now, really, the Weaver incident is a great one to bring up here. It seems like the perfect nexus. Now that it's post-Oklahoma City and post-9/11 and post-Military Commissions Act, what would happen to Randy Weaver now? Would they not just call him a terrorist, a domestic terrorist, and an enemy combatant? Would he get a trial at all?
Well, I don't think that the feds wanted to try him. I mean, I think that the feds would have probably much preferred to see him dead rather than sitting in court having a chance, having lawyers examine the federal case against him. By the way, Helen Chenoweth, who was the congresswoman from Idaho in the mid-late 90s, died yesterday in a car crash. She was one of the most courageous members of Congress, both on Ruby Ridge and on other things. She fought much harder than the Idaho senators did to find out the truth about the federal killings at Ruby Ridge. She was very, very courageous, but it's interesting. It's a sign of our times. I've read a couple of obituaries on her today, and they have mentioned that she had accused the feds of using black helicopter gunships. And this is mentioned in those obits as if it was a sign that Chenoweth was a little bit loony. You know, I wonder, is there a federal law that prohibits obituary writers from thinking about looking at the footage of the first assault of the feds on Waco on February 8th, 1993? There were large helicopter gunships going around the large house that Branch Davidian lived in. There was apparently gunfire from the helicopter down into the house that may have killed several innocent people there.
Yep.
And yet, people that talk about black helicopters are simply, we are supposed to assume that they have nothing which we should hear. I mean, yep. It wasn't Chenoweth's fault the feds used National Guard helicopters in the Waco attack.
Yeah, well, and it was Ann Richards, also recently deceased, that gave the helicopters to her to use. In the name of the drug war, that was the loophole in Posse Comitatus, was they lied about a non-existent drug lab on David Koresh's property.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but a flip side is Waco, Ruby Ridge, in some ways set the groundwork for what we're seeing now, because there were horrendous federal lies. And they were clear from the get-go, from anybody paying attention, on both Ruby Ridge and Waco. And the feds pretty much got away with them. People should not forget the response of the Washington media to the FBI final attack at Waco, which left 80 people dead, mostly women and children. It was complete debacle. You had the FBI going in there, pumping in toxic flammable gas in there for hours in this battered house, which was very flammable. Fire breaks out, fire starts somehow, all these people die. What was the Washington media's response? It made Janet Reno a hero.
Yeah.
And Reno was a hero throughout her term in office, in spite of the absolute atrocity which she was responsible for in authorizing the FBI to use tanks and toxic gas against American civilians.
And you know, it's funny, because you ask yourself now, does anybody to this day believe that was a suicide? I don't think anybody does anymore. I mean, worst case, the Davidians, it was an accident, you know?
I would bet many people do think it was a suicide, or people think it was justified that the government killed them. I mean, you know, with the mindset out there, you know...
Waco really was the test, wasn't it, Jim? Waco was the test. Can we use the military against Americans and get away with it? And the answer was yes, we can.
I don't know if it was a test or not, but there was a pro-gun rally I spoke at on the right in front of the Lincoln Memorial back in August 1994, and there was a guy from Pennsylvania who had said something which sticks in my mind. He said if the FBI came in there and did the same thing in Pennsylvania which they did in Texas, that the FBI would face more guns on the way out than they faced on the way in. There were some Americans who got it. There were some Americans who said, you know, this is too much of an outrage. This we cannot tolerate. But, by and large, the feds got away with it.
Yeah, well, and then Bush got elected, and all those people fell in line behind the state anyway.
Yeah, well, I mean, fell in line is putting it mildly. I mean, they fell on their knees.
Yeah, exactly, on their bellies.
Acting like a Capitol Hill page.
Oh, God. Oh, Jim. Well, yeah, and you know, you talk in your book about, during the torture scandal, about basically their plan for getting away with it was just to wax indignant and just say, how dare you accuse us of being torturers, and you're on the side of the enemy, and they basically just blew it off. And
yeah, well,
and I guess people looked at it and said, well, gee, if they're blowing it off, it must not be a big deal.
Well, and here again, the role of the Washington media, the national establishment media, is vital, because Bush, from the get-go, Bush and his team were brazenly lying about what had happened and intentionally covering up the vast majority of the abuses, which they continue to do to this day. We've probably not yet seen the tip of the iceberg of the interrogation abuses committed since 9/11. But the, basically what they did was promise that there would be an investigation. There were a few cover-up reports which were, brought out and run around the track, and said, well, you had 7 or 8 reports. What more could you want? Facts, truth, honesty. I'm amazed at how easy it was for the Bush team to basically lie their way through the torture scandal. And a major reason why Bush was able to get his torture bill put into law by Congress last week was because the establishment and the liberal media did not have the courage to consistently go after this stuff. New York Times had almost a full page size memo excerpt from John Yoo's new book 2 weeks ago, just at the time that the debate about the torture stuff was heating up. And New York Times op-ed page chooses to showcase John Yoo, who was the torture mastermind. New York Times had a very good editorial against the bill on the day after it passed the House.
Nice.
Well, that's that's great. It brings to mind what Bonaparte said about the Austrian army. They were always 15 minutes too late.
Yeah. And but the New York Times, they're a lot longer than 15 minutes or a day usually. I guess we should be lucky that we got one the day after it passed rather than, 5 years from now.
Well, yeah, I mean, liberals and leftists in general have done far better as far as fighting and exposing some of the abuses of Bush, but the most prominent ones have usually flinched or kowtowed. Scott, what was your impression of how much libertarians did to oppose the torture stuff? Because anti-war certainly did a lot. There was good stuff on Rockwell, some other places, but I didn't hear that much elsewhere. What was your impression?
I don't even know. I sure didn't have anything intrude into my view of the Libertarian Party making any statements or anything. If they're par for the course, I'm sure they did nothing. Of course, antiwar.com and lewrockwell.com and places like that are never going to let us down on the torture question. But what effect they really have in the larger view, I don't know. I mean, antiwar.com gets over 100,000 unique visitors a day, but this is a country of 300 million people. And that's worldwide stats, so
right.
It's pretty bad. Although, and this really cuts to another point that I kind of wanted to get your insight on here. And by the way, for people just tuning in, James Bovard is the guest. This is the Chaos Report, and we're talking about his book, Attention Deficit Democracy. And you talked earlier about Bob Woodward basically just being the in-house establishment guy. You talked about the New York Times. Supine as they reprint John Yoo's treatise, trying to get this bill through, and yet at the same time, there's this whole, I guess, view of the Bush administration that has it that the neocons, in alliance with these crazy right-wing Nixonians, have basically just seized power away from the rest of the establishment and are kind of doing their own thing. But particularly when you bring up the Washington Post and the New York Times basically going along with this, it really brings up the question of whether, in my mind, it brings up the question of whether this split really even exists at all.
Yeah, and, if you think the Washington Post editorial page still supports the war in Iraq, and the Post endorsed Joe Lieberman for the U.S. Senate, partly because of his pro-war stance a week or two ago. Just appalling stuff. This is a bad transition, but I want to get in the plug. I've got a website, www.jimbovard, and I've got a blog there, jimbovard.com/blog, and people might get some laughs out of the blog and might enjoy some of the articles on the website. I don't know how much more time we have left, but I figured I'd... I was thinking my NASCAR moment.
Yeah, there you go. You plug away, and the show's another hour, and I still have at least a few more questions.
Oh, so really? Oh,
there's
okay.
No hurry. As long as you have time, but you know, I'm not going to try to keep you on for the whole 2 hours here, Jim. But
that's right.
We're not up against the time wall either.
I was thinking it was a 1 hour program.
Oh no, I wouldn't tolerate just an hour. I couldn't.
Okay.
But yeah, so what about that though? The establishment and the neoconservatives, is this just one and the same thing?
It's not one and the same thing, but there's a lot more overlap than people recognize. It's interesting to see who are the prominent columnists at the most visible newspapers, and it's fascinating. The neocons, by and large, were completely wrong about the war in Iraq. Many of them had bought into this notion of that we'd be greeted by with flowers and kisses and hugs. It hasn't quite happened there in Baghdad or elsewhere. But these folks were so wrong, but they are still the men of wisdom, basically. And they are, but you know, the same has been true of Henry Kissinger for 30 years. Kissinger was well known in for telling a great number of lies when he was in power. If not since then, and yet he's still showcased by the Washington Post editorial page and many other places.
Right. Well, and in fact, he's really at the heart of what I'm talking about. You know, the new Woodward book has come out and says that Kissinger has been advising Cheney and Bush personally pretty much this whole time. And yet my understanding was always that Kissinger was the establishment's man, that the neocons had cut their teeth fighting against Kissinger during the days of détente in the Ford administration, and that, you know, this guy Kissinger ought to be representing the so-called realists who, for example, don't want to spread the war into Iran. And yet it seems like Kissinger's on the side of the neocons. His guy Bremer in Iraq too did the neocons agenda, not the oil men's agenda.
Right. And it's typical of the how the Washington Post viewed Bremer and the Bush administration and the war in Iraq. Bremer came back and there was a big spread on him, if memory serves, in the Washington Post food section. That showed him walk out of the kitchen holding some of the favorite dishes he'd cooked and talking about the things that his favorite recipes.
Oh my God.
So it was just like,
Bremer's favorite recipes.
I think that was it. There was
show Sliders where it was a really crappy show, but they slide from dimension to dimension. I got stuck in the wrong one somewhere. I don't know how I ended up here with you crazy people, seriously.
It was funny. It was funny as hell. It was, you know, there was a lady from IPS, Institute for Policy Studies, who wrote a wonderful letter to the Washington Post afterwards, really busting your chops. But this, you know, Bremer was part of the establishment, and and he was always well dressed, and he sort of looked like a viceroy. So you know, that was part of the reason why he was embraced by the Washington establishment. But as far as this, you know, with Kissinger, Kissinger was Bush's first choice to be head of the 9/11 Commission, which that was announced around Thanksgiving 2002. And I haven't forgotten. I was traveling in Southwest Virginia at that point and was doing a long drive and came to this gas station late one night and saw a New York Times sitting on the vending machine there, and it had a big picture of Kissinger above the fold. And I was thinking, it's great. He's been indicted for war crimes. I said, oh, this is a great day. And then I saw, no, he's been nominated to head the 9/11 Commission. And I said, okay, that's a bummer. I just felt like, you know, oh, shit.
That's so funny, too. You know, 2 days before September 11th, that Sunday on 60 Minutes, they did a whole thing about Kissinger and his war crimes, his participation in the coup in Chile and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many things. The absent father in East Timor, Kissinger bears some responsibility for that. So, but it doesn't matter. I mean, Kissinger is still respectable, no matter how many lies he's told, no matter how many people have died. So,
yeah, I remember the Onion had a headline: the limbless children of Cambodia award Kissinger the Nobel Peace Prize.
Oh, that's good.
And the child says, "I would hug you if I had the necessary appendages."
That's great. Yeah. That's great.
Anyway, well, so I don't know. Kissinger wrote something in the LA Times, I don't know, a month or two ago that said, "Hey, don't bomb Iran, talk to Iran." And yet, all the news last week is that there's ships and minesweepers and all kinds of things being prepared for the air war against Iran. Kissinger just BSing me in the LA Times, or do you think he's actually counseling caution?
You know,
it's hard to tell
know.
From outside, isn't it?
It's hard to know. You know, it's hard to know what Kissinger is saying. It's hard to know what Bush is doing. And Congress doesn't really give a darn at this point. So,
well, hey, nobody else does either. And what do you call that in the book? Battered citizen syndrome, right?
Oh yeah, battered citizen syndrome. Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit? Expand on that a little bit. What's battered citizen syndrome, Jim?
Battered citizen syndrome is when people have been fear-mongered year after year and are basically frightened into submission. In cases where folks know that the government might be lying to them or has lied to them in the past, and yet they're so frightened that they cling to the faith of the government.
Yeah. And it really is just like some girl you once knew whose boyfriend beat her up, isn't it? It's the very same psychology.
Yeah, and it's working. It's working well for the entire country. It worked well in the period just before the 2004 election, which Bush won by about 3%. Coincidentally, there was a study by Cornell University, which showed that the president's approval rating rose 3% after each terror warning the federal government issued.
Yeah.
So
I'm sure they didn't notice that, though.
Well, there were so many bogus alarms that those folks issued in 2004. So, you know, some days it's really hard not to get cynical.
Yeah. Well, so is there a solution to any of this? Is there a lesson to be learned at all here? What's the deal? We're fucked, basically, is the deal.
Well, you know, the people need to drink good beer. That's the bottom line. I mean, you know, good beer is part of the answer. People need to pay attention. People need to call politicians liars. People need to taunt them. One thing that occurred to me is it'd be great if we had people showing up at the campaign speeches of these congressmen that voted for torture. Have people showing up dressed like that guy at Abu Ghraib who had that drape and had the wires hanging from his body. Just to haunt these people, to make them feel some public wrath and hostility. And keep calling them liars, because that's what they are. And people need to fight to find out the truth. People need not to give up. But there's no one riding in on the white horse. There's no savior coming in. So maybe someday things will get better.
All right. Well, everybody, that's James Bovard. He's the author of Lost Rights, Freedom in Chains, The Farm Fiasco, The Fair Trade Fraud, Shakedown, Feeling Your Pain, Terrorism and Tyranny, The Bush Betrayal, and the latest and my favorite, and you really ought to run out and go get it. It's awesome. Attention Deficit Democracy. The chapter on torture in this book is the best book about the American government's torture of people in this bogus war on terrorism that you can find. It's an excellent book, Attention Deficit Democracy. And please, everyone, check out jimbovard.com, or you can always link over to Jim from my blog, thestressblog.com. Thank you very much for your time today, Jim.
Hey, Scott, thanks for having me on. It was lots of fun, and I hope you all raised lots of hell down there.
We're going to keep trying.
Down there and everywhere around the world.
Yeah, and I'll be seeing you on the anti-war blog, my friend.
All right, hey, thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Jim. All right, everybody, this is the Chaos Report, and we'll be right back.
We interrupt this program with a special bulletin. America is now under martial law. All constitutional rights have been suspended. Stay in your home. Do not attempt to contact loved ones
insurance agent or attorney. Shut up. Do not attempt to think or depression may occur. Stay in your home. Curfew is at 7 p.m. sharp after work. Anyone caught outside the gates of their subdivision sectors after curfew will be shot. Remain calm. Do not panic. Your neighborhood watch officer will be by to collect urine samples in the morning. Anyone caught interfering with the collection of urine samples will be shot. Stay in your home. Remain calm. The number one enemy of progress is questions. National security is more important than individual will. All sports broadcasts will proceed as normal. No more than two people may gather anywhere without permission. Use only the drugs prescribed by your boss or supervisor. Shut up! Be happy! Obey all orders without question. The comfort you demanded is now mandatory. Be happy. At last, everything is done for you.